Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion at the Gallipoli Club on Ukraine. Our speaker, Dr. Walter Zariski, is... he studied at Columbia University. He taught for 30 years at New York University and is currently doing postdoctoral work on the history of the Solidarity Movement. Our speaker's visit to Australia has been organised by the Australian Federation of Ukrainian Organisations, and thanks to Peter Schmeagle, who's one of our members, for making this possible tonight. So our speaker's going to talk on the topic of Ukraine, strategic linchpin for the next Bosnia. Dr. Zariski, you're very welcome. Thank you.
I'm coming to you via a series of meetings that I had to have with the sponsors that have asked me here. We had very fruitful discussions. We realized that Australia is a major player. We would like to convince the Australians to understand how important they really are and their position is in the world these days. Number one, in terms of their moral throwing power, number one or two, it always depends on whether you pick the Australians or the Canadians. And most people pick Australia more than Canada because of your lovely weather as well as everything else. So your throw power, as your soft power, is unbelievable. And in addition, you also have the positions of a serious member in the UN Security Council. You also chair the G20. So you have an enormous amount of responsibility in terms of what the global structure will look like in the next decades. And that's why this issue that we're about to raise today, that I'm about to raise with you today, is one that vitally affects you as well as everyone else. What is going on in Ukraine may in fact have a a deep impact on the world in the next year or two. Let me start with this. I've been asked to address a critical question by the Sydney Institute in a key country and a key player in the Crimean drama unfolding in Ukraine as chair of the G20 and as a member of the Security Council. The question is Ukraine a strategic linchpin or the next Bosnia? If I had been pressed for a short answer, I would have made the following 4 points. First, without question, Ukraine is a global pivot point, without question. And with no jest intended, as anybody who's ever played the world-famed Parker Brothers game of Risk will attest, Ukraine is the gateway to Europe, eternally on guard against moves from the east, whether from the north, which is historically Muscovy, the center, historically the Mongols, or the south, historically the Ottomans. Second, the country is not naturally a Bosnia. Any serious glance at the news archives from Ukraine since its independence in 1991 would indicate that the one thing that Ukraine has not suffered is ethnic violence. Second, the country is not naturally a Bosnia, and any serious glance at news archives from Ukraine since its independence in 1991 indicate that the one thing Ukraine has not suffered, is ethnic violence. We've had the corruption. We've had managed democracy. We've seen all sorts of forms of things that might upset the society and the state. But the one thing we have not seen is ethnic violence. Third, precisely because Ukraine is a strategic linchpin, it could find itself transformed into a Bosnia artificially Such an induced change might just fit the strategic purposes of a party needing Ukraine to pivot in that direction. Now, finally, if such a transformation did occur, therefore, if Ukraine did indeed become the next Bosnia, it would be more difficult to manage than the original Bosnia that had those problems. The repercussions on Europe and the world would be far greater. Why? Precisely because I'm being allowed to elaborate. Some of this has been published in an article I heard today in the Australian. But I will elaborate on all the points that have been made. And I will essentially dwell on each of those points made simply with more precision and more substance. With regard to whether Ukraine is indeed a strategic linchpin, one can actually advance three rock-solid arguments. Not one, but three. Actually, they have now multiplied as a result of what I've been of my discussions. We probably have six. And since I have some time, we might be able to touch some all of them. One, the geopolitical argument that that best expresses why Ukraine is a linchpin was probably expressed over a decade ago by a very astute senior staffer on the U.S. House of Representatives International Affairs Committee at a D.C. forum. I know because I chaired it. Dedicated to examining relations between the Euro-Atlantic community and Ukraine. And his words still stick in my mind 15 years later. Until now, the honorable speakers have contemplated the benefits of NAFTA, which is the Mexican-Canadian-U.S. trade agreement. NAFTA, EU, Ukraine as a triangle. We might want to consider the opposite to really understand what is at stake. Let us instead imagine for a moment a Ukraine-Russia-China triangle. Ukrainian rockets to Russia, Ukrainian wheat to China, Ukrainian assistance to various rogue states and entities. Who then could blame China and Russia for some unimaginable tragedy that would immeasurably weaken the West? Now, I add to this one on the geopolitical level, because I've listened to it, both the advice of my old professor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and the advice of Henry Kissinger, two very large-scale geostrategists, both of whom, and no one knows where exactly that phrase came from, but both of whom at one point or another have expressed this sentiment. Russia with Ukraine is an empire. Russia without Ukraine can become something else. Now, on the geoeconomic level, instead of just one, as I gave earlier in the article, I give two. The first one I encountered at a recent forum. When asked to name the five countries absolutely essential to feeding the world in this century, a top Wall Street analyst, an expert on that issue, named five. And please note, you're one of the five. Argentina, Australia, though you've had a bit of drought these days, but Argentina, Australia, Canada, the United States, and Ukraine. And I add to this, geoeconomic, a second. Whereas 15 years ago we were worried about where China and Russia would be together, there's another kind of China, the China that has been engaged in trade, and just think of this geoeconomic scenario. A China-India-Oceania, or Pacific Rim democracies, on one side. A large-scale NAFTA and Latin American plus your EU market on the other side. And in between, two transport routes. The southern, which is the classic Silk Road, and the northern, which is through the snows of Siberia. We know that the Russians convinced everybody when it came to the help in Afghanistan, convinced the Americans, you can't do it through Kyrgyzstan, you can't do it through Uzbekistan, you can't trust those Ukrainians in Crimea. So use our air bases up north. Well, that's fine and dandy. But in the great transport corridors that the world will need in the mid and late 21st century, we're talking about a southern route and a northern route. And on the southern route, Ukraine lies smack dab in the middle. Black Sea. Right in the middle. Geoculturally, the third solid argument. It is clear, anyone remotely acquainted with the work that the EU has done with the six member states of the Eastern Partnership Initiative, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Belarus, Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine, any one of them will swear on any number of holy books that Ukraine is a key to the Eastern Partnership's central role, finally making Europe whole, free, and at peace. Is the regional leader. But in addition, and I will now add this because of the discussions I had heard today, in addition, and it's as a result of an article about a Russian Democrat who happened to have been an old industrialist who's been recently let out of jail, Khodorkovsky, who arrived in Kiev today and said, and he repeated something, again I'm going to bring my old professor Zbig into the picture, repeated something that Zbig had said to us at a forum about six, seven years ago. Zbigniew Brzezinski told the Ukrainians that you're the older brother, not the younger brother. This was during the Orange Revolution. You're the one that doesn't get into as many fights as the younger brother does. And in historical terms, we are the older brother. In historical terms and in geographic terms, in all senses, we are the older brother. And ironically, the younger brother, with all his Dostoevskys and Tolstoys and so on and so forth, often looks to us, even during the bad old days of the Decembrists in the South. Those Decembrists in the South were located in Ukraine. And what was happening with Nicholas and the characters, the unholy alliance of the North. Remember that they look to us, and Khodorkovsky repeated it, if you folks can succeed in democracy, there's a good chance that we might someday succeed in democracy. And instead of having this return, as Fukuyama calls it, there's one thing that may challenge constitutional democracy at the end, maybe it isn't the end of history, maybe that some sort of bizarre fascism might do it. Well, I hate to say it, what you're beginning to see with this managed democracy up there in the North may just be that. Just think of how good it would be if the Ukrainian example actually got to the Russian internet middle class. We saw a possibility of that in 2012. We can't discount it. And just think of what would happen if the world saw a democratic Pacific Rim that's extending itself because of Australia's really remarkable, you know, authority in this area. But at the same time, another democratic strip that would run from Dublin to Vladivostok. Okay. So these are the things at stake that we're talking about. Is Ukraine geostrategic? Yes, it is. So the second question now comes. On the issue of Ukraine being the next Bosnia, any of the same aforementioned students of the regions that I had mentioned would also swear that Ukraine does not contain any areas that exhibit the kind of age-old ethnic animosities one might see amongst the country's neighbors. You don't have any Nagorno-Karabakhs. You don't have any Transnistrias. You know, do not have the South Ossetias or the Abkhazias, or for that matter, if our northern neighbor were to look in the mirror, we don't have any Chechenias, and Dagestan's. For a time in the 1990s, U.S. intelligence services did see Crimea as a potential frozen conflict zone. That's the term of choice for such troubled areas. But eventually discovered that the three-way ethnic split on the peninsula, the Ukrainians, the Tatars, and the ethnic Russians, were always in a classic, for use of a better term, Mexican standoff. Nobody would pull the trigger, precisely because all three ethnic groups understood that they'd have to live in peace, otherwise there would be a lot of chaos. So Crimea, the American intelligence folks then that had been swearing to our people in the States, the think tanks in the States, that something might happen in Crimea. It didn't, precisely because there was a classic lock, and folks actually learned how to live with each other for the next 20 years. So Crimea is not a natural area for this sort of Bosnia-like activity. Age-old animosities go back to the 13th, 14th century. Unless someone invents that. Second, again, following the Orange Revolution, there was some talk of separatism. This Mr. Kushnirov, who eventually dies. Some sort of growing east-west divide. But if the time had been for an east-west divide that everybody talks about now, it would have been right after the Orange Revolution. Because at that point, there was this sort of uplifting and the spirit of the center and west and having won the signal victory. And yet it was very clear that the east and the south, it was not their candidate that won. We could have seen some of that, and it didn't happen. It didn't happen in 2004, 2005. Which now leads us to the third point. That Ukraine's position as a global pivot point might seduce a party interested in seeing Ukraine pivot in its direction for strategic advantage into creating an artificial frozen conflict zone a la Bosnia on Ukraine's soil. Now, I know that this third point might initially incur a skeptical reception. It might seem like a bit of a stretch. But even a cursory closer examination will reveal that this is exactly what has happened. From the moment of Vladimir Putin's ascension to power in the 99-2000 period, with his self-proclaimed mandate to restore the greatness of Russia, to right the wrong of the collapse of the USSR, and equally from the time of Bill Clinton's historic speech in June 2000 in Kiev, promoting Ukraine as a potential strategic partner for the U.S. in particular and for the entire Euro-Atlantic community in general, a jostling, not a cold war, not even a sort of cool war, as someone, some wit has used it with the Obama-Putin issue these days, but a jostling between the two names sides that I put, Clinton here, Putin here, for Ukraine's attention. It began in earnest in 2000. We thought that it might change with W, but it didn't. W. Bush walks into Warsaw in June of 2001, this is before 9/11, and says, we will continue that strategic partnership with Ukraine. And Putin understood it from his side, so he continued his work. Now, how did they continue the work? The West concentrated on the masses and talked about promoting genuine democracy. We knew because our center did a lot of conferences. We did 60 conferences during this period of time. And it was talked about promoting genuine democracy, the rule of law, installing a mature market economy, enhancing both general and energy security, increased social and ethnic cohesion, and creating an established and yet tolerant national identity. That was what the West was trying to sell through the civil society programs that they were creating. It wasn't to the state, it was to civil society. They were actually worried about giving it to someone like Kuchma in his time. Putin, on the other hand, concentrated on Ukraine's old red directory elite and talked about what? All the fun things. Managed democracy. You saw how that has been working out with elections. The joys of kleptocracy. Security and energy interdependence. We know how that worked out in the gas wars. The strength of Ukrainian Russian brotherhood, and we used to jest a la Batman and Robin. And the benefits of a Eurasian identity instead of a national identity. It turns out that the Ukrainian masses bought one side and the Ukrainian elites bought into the other side. And a set of tussles ensued between the elites and the masses. In 2001, it was called Gungazagate and Maidan Biskuchmia. In 2004, it was called the Orange Revolution. In 2013, it became the Euromaidan that you've seen. Larger than the first two. Much larger. December 1st, December 8th, and December 15th, we're talking about, when I was in Kyiv this last week, we're talking about the folks who know the measures, the architects who know the area. So if we're talking about in the range of 400, 500, and that last one, 850, perhaps a million people. That's a lot of people in one place. The masses managed by... It turns out that this is what the Euromaidan meant, and when it turned violent as a result of what the elites did to the masses, it turned into an uprising. And by February 24th, 25th, 14th, the tussle yielded a firm decision. The masses managed to pull over the elites to their side, or actually put in place a new elite beholden to them, and gave a definite nod to the West. That doesn't mean that they were, that anybody in the West was ready for EU or NATO or whatever. It was that the Ukrainians voted with their feet to embrace Western value systems, something that we understand wherever we have democracy. You folks represent it in the nth degree. You folks live in perhaps the finest democracy in the world. People ask, why Australia? Now, recognizing and probably even anticipating that such an outcome was possible if he pushed matters too far, Putin had one great secret play left. In old American football terms, we call that the Hail Mary pass. While the Ukrainian nation might want to head west, the West would be reluctant to accept such a pivot if Ukraine had problems with its neighbors or national minorities. That we heard from the first time we talked about Ukraine possibly doing anything in NATO or EU. So voila, my French is a little under the weather. So voila, the very same problem instantly appeared. We had had none of those problems, and suddenly, instantly, Crimea is suddenly the poster child for ethnic unrest. And you watch these self-defense units everywhere, and possibly in Donetsk and Luhansk and possibly other provinces. But you wonder, self-defense in full uniforms, with helicopters, with armored cars, possibly with tanks, and then you look at the self-defense units that defended the Maidan with all sorts of little, you know, football helmets that they borrowed from their American cousins or Canadian cousins. And you said, self-defense units? And so, suddenly Ukraine was looking exactly like the next Bosnia. Hence the origin of the phrase, the next Bosnia. But But now, with regard to that final point I made, namely that Ukraine, if it were to remain a Bosnia, albeit artificial, would be harder to contain as a crisis point than the original Bosnia was. Three information bullets are necessary on this one, but I'm going to add a fourth because Crimean Tartars have spoken in the last 2 days. First, if the animosity that Putin has created with his intrusion into the internal affairs of Ukraine, with his Crimean incursion, were to turn into a general Russian-Ukrainian conflict, and it might with this referendum. I know that people have criticized Hillary Clinton for comparing Putin to Hitler. But Hitler and Mussolini, when they did Sudetenland, asked for a referendum from the West. They came and said, we're going to run this referendum. And they talked to Dudley and they talked to Chamberlain. Putin has decided to talk to no one about this referendum that's happening in 4 days. In 4 days. With a Ukrainian army and navy presence on Crimea. How's that going to work out? So, if one were to look at the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, even a potential conflict, one has to look at this, that the struggle would be protracted and messy, possibly with immeasurable casualties. Now, why? Well, someone who's run a conference on the terror famine, we did it last November in New York, and we got 60 scholars together, and we realized, man, what that terrible thing meant, the last union that Ukrainians had with its northern neighbors. Whether you like the word genocide or not, Raphael Lemkin used the word genocide on it, and he's the father of the word. And he said the Ukrainian terror famine was a genocide. You can imagine those characters now watching what's going on. I'm not quite sure those folks, man, that defended the Maidan would be any happier in the battle that they had with Yanukovych, whether they would be very much happier if Putin moved into Ukraine. And so what we have to imagine is that this would be a conflict much larger than anything we could possibly anticipate at this point. That's one. Two, if it were a messy conflict, as it would be predicted to be, then the immeasurable migration patterns that you'd start getting. We're talking about not hundreds of thousands, but millions of people pouring across all sorts of borders. Two. Three. It may be an unkind term, but it's now used in the United States. It's called Sudeten Russians. The Sudeten Russian question is not just simply a question of Ukraine. Russians, as Russian ethnics, exist men throughout that Central Asian, there are all the stands, and Kazakhstan especially, is vulnerable on this issue. But more important than that, the Baltic states, all three members of NATO, have larger ethnic problems on one level than the Ukrainians, because their language laws are far harsher on the issue in terms of citizenship than anything the Ukrainians ever passed, including this newest one that everybody accused and apparently the interim president vetoed. So you can imagine that what Putin may be unleashing, even if he no longer wants to do, because he says, well, NATO, he may be unleashing an ethnic animosity in places that are NATO members. An attack on Vilnius would be an attack on Nutley, New Jersey. And an attack on Nutley, New Jersey has to have an appropriate response. A response that would allow my daughter to tell me, Dad, you're lucky you're going to Australia after being in Ukraine in Simferopol, because this is where that crazy movie that you made me once watch, On the Beach, this is where humanity finally, and whatever's left of it, might be able to survive at least 6 months more than anybody else does. And if someone thinks that's a joke, They should have listened to Jan Ellison, a good friend of mine, Assistant Secretary General of the UN. As he spoke, I'm leaving Ukraine, and he's on BBC, on the Maidan, and he says, when I watched those Ukrainian soldiers unarmed, but knew that the Ukrainian soldiers had a couple of boys, men with rifles in the back, covered their back, and the Russians were there with their rifles and then shooting in the air, he said, I thought that this was a Sarajevo moment, but it isn't our Sarajevo of the Bosnia of the 90s. What he was thinking about is the Sarajevo of 1914, the shot that began a world war. And that's what we're dealing with at this point. Someone has to understand that this is what we've come to. And the fourth. I will add the fourth as the final. 2 days ago, those same Crimean Tartars, the gentlest of souls, deported unfairly in 1944, accused of all sorts of crimes, fascist collaboration and everything else, deported. With none of that having been true. Deported into Central Asia, managed to come back to Ukraine, filter back into Crimea the last 20 years. They now represent 13 to 15%. They have now been finding themselves antagonized in the last 4 days with crosses all over the place on their homes, as if to warn, we will come after you. One. And two, their response has been, our co-religionists are telling us, if you stand and fight, we will fight with you. Now, folks, use your imagination. The same character, Putin, who's told us, man, that watch it, and, in Syria, you folks, there are no good guys, there are no bad guys, because Al-Qaeda has now come to town, and it's roosting out there. And, that's why we may have to keep Assad. This same Putin, who's been given credit for really understanding the situation in Syria, that same Putin is capable of doing something. He is now creating a circumstance. And Ariel Cohen just wrote an article today, one of the more sophisticated folks in Washington from the Heritage Foundation, that states this exact point. He says, Al-Qaeda is coming to Crimea. Now, just think that Putin is planting the possibility of an Al-Qaeda situation right on the doorstep of Europe. You got the picture? Maybe you're right about the Pacific Rim. Someone joked and said, they used to brag in Europe that they all had it all together, and you folks then still have the authoritarian regimes that, with Malaysia and Indonesia, Vietnam and so on. Well, it turns out that in the last 15 years, your neck of the woods has become very advanced, and nobody wants even the PRC, as we used to lovingly call it, wants to trade with people and wants to be a honorable citizen. Meanwhile, what has happened is in Europe is going back into folks, we're not quite sure, because if you start with Sudeten Russians in the Baltics, but you also start with the mistreatment of Muslims in the center of Europe. Ukraine is geographically a central piece in Europe. How long does it take before the Kosovars and the Bosnians, the real Bosnians, who have been feeling that they can be integrated into Europe, how long will it be before they might start feeling, this is not working all that well? Especially when Putin is walking with a very large Russian Orthodox cross spewing Ruski Mir. So, with that, I leave you with the last and a final tiny postscript. It would be remiss of me not to add that Putin's clever Crimean Hail Mary pass has actually shredded the notion of territorial integrity upon which the United Nations Charter is based. He simply said, territorial integrity is not my business. But territorial integrity and the stopping of one nation aggressing against another is why we created the League of Nations, why we created the United Nations, why we created the OSCEs and the G8s and the G20s and the WTOs, so that we wouldn't go through this parade again. And we're about to do it again in 4 days. So, is Ukraine the next Bosnia? We hope not, though it might be. Is it a strategic linchpin? You bet. And that's why it's so important that we wake up and understand that if it goes, it will create consequences that we haven't even begun to imagine. That's my piece. Thank you.
Thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. I should have mentioned earlier that Dr. Walter Zariski is also currently Executive Director of the Center for U.S.-Ukrainian Relations based in New York and Washington. So let's look at that part of your role in contemporary United States. You've given us a very comprehensive view about Ukraine, about Russia and some other nations in that area. But what about the United States? I mean, the impression that we seem to get from the West these days is that the Obama administration looks incredibly weak. Not merely is it difficult for the US to do much in that region, as it was through the 50s and 60s and during the Cold War period, but that the Obama administration doesn't really want to do anything because it doesn't really know what it might do. I mean, is the lack of American leadership a problem here, or is that a misconception? Hmm. So if you come back here and talk to the end of the room.
And you do have a reputation for giving some of the best moderators questions of all time. So you've lived up to it. The U.S., until recently, I probably as someone who does run an NGO in D.C., probably was not all that happy about the response by the United States. I remember that this is the Friday before I left, actually, for Ukraine, and President Obama had gotten on TV, and he had started talk about territorial integrity, and we need to honor territorial integrity, but he talked about the common history of Russia with Ukraine, all the words then that we understood, oh boy, this is going to be, why don't you folks, man, just sit down together. This is after Putin has actually said, there's no government in Kiev, so I'm not going to be sitting down with anybody. But you sensed, man, that President Obama's first position was not that strong. But from that point on, precisely because we had a very good group, we had created through our center, we had created Friends of Ukraine, former ambassadors, Taylor, Herbst, Pasquale, Miller, Courtney Smith. Someone, and we were in an e-chain, the joys of internet. Within one day, we heard a very different Obama, and he actually sent out the material to us. We heard his side of that debate between him and Putin in that 90 minutes. This was a Saturday. Friday and Saturday, we heard that he is now taking a much harder stand. By Sunday, John Kerry gets on the talk shows, and he's talking about every option is on the table. And when we heard the word military option, we said, whoa. Even the Ukrainians haven't asked for a military option. But we understood what they meant. And folks, in some ways, if Putin understood what was going on, he would understand that he actually, in the long term, and it may be one of the benefits, that if James Shearer, a very famous analyst from Britain, divides Putin from Putinism, this may come to bite Putinism and his Putinist friends, because they may think that he may have bit more than he could chew. Because within 3 days of that declaration, suddenly, what NATO can do, NATO can put warships in the Black Sea, because the Black Sea is not a Russian lake. Two, NATO for the first time is talking about F-16s to the Baltic states. Nobody would have been talking about that in the Olympics. Eastern Europe, that's, you know, Eastern Europe is NATO, but then we can defend NATO, we can defend Eastern Europe from Central and Western Europe. Suddenly, Putin now has F-16s in the Baltic states, F-16s in Romania, F-16s in Bulgaria, warships showing up in the Black Sea. And he's, if he pushes it, he may find that the sanctions that the Americans are suggesting, because they've got him on the books, no one else does, but they've had him on the books for a long time. It's called the Magnitsky Laws. They were intended to punish the folks that were killing all those journalists, including poor Litvinenko, and folks that were whistleblowers on the Russians, including Litvinenko dying of polonium on BBC. All of that was noted by the Americans back in the day, back in 2007 and 2008. And the Democrats and Republicans bilaterally had passed something called the Magnitsky Laws. And this is very important to remember, because we've been talking about visa regime against Yanukovych and visa and freezing the assets of the Ukrainians. Those guys are gone. The bozos are gone. The Ukrainian puppets are gone. We need their money back in the budget. And we certainly need it. We need Europe to find that money to give it back. But there is a new set of laws, and it turns out that even if Obama didn't want to, he has to, I mean, it's a law. If individuals in Russian politics engage in either violation of human rights or in war crimes, and who would have thought war crimes, but aggressing against the country and walking across its borders with an army, that might constitute something like that. There is an element in American politics that's willing to go that far. So the Americans may not no longer be the problem. They might have been early. The problem may be in Europe. And I want everybody to ask me, I'll let that hang there and let people ask me, why in Europe?
Okay. So we're going to finish on the hour. So just stay here. Stay here.
Right. I'm running away.
No. Don't run away. No.
Oh, please,
okay.
Please.
There's a question here, but it's got to be loud. We've got to pick it up in the podcast. Yeah. Then we go down the back. Yep.
Given your excellent analysis, but fundamentally, could Russia, given its history, tolerate a hostile or Western-leaning Ukraine?
Okay.
Wouldn't it mean the end of Russia as a global power, which it obviously intends to be?
Okay, could Russia tolerate a Western-friendly Ukraine if it wants to remain a global power?
Well, that was the point that Kissinger and Brzezinski at different points had made. The problem is that that question begs another question, which is that question that everybody sort of drops, and that's the Russian near abroad, that the Russians need a buffer zone. I hate to say it, I'm not the biggest fan of Sarah Palin, but Sarah Palin was right. She could see the Russians on her window. And Alaska is the near abroad. And ask our Canadian friends about the way the Russians are dealing with mining in the Arctic Circle and treating the Canadians as the near abroad. Now, where do you draw the line on what is near abroad? Is Alaska, which used to belong to the Russians until 1867, if I remember my American history correctly. Old Bill Stewart then ended up buying it from the Russians. Does that mean that those sixth generation Russian ethnics in Alaska might not suddenly become the Sudeten Russians? I mean, where do you draw the line on that? Because it turns out that Hillary was not wrong. She's actually, aside from the fact that she wants the Eastern European vote in 16. Oh, sorry, that's an unkind cut. The fact is, she is right that there are ways to look at what Putin is doing is exactly what Hitler was doing. All I want to do is reunite the Germans. You give me a little here and a little there, And that's all I want. I want a little Austria and a little Czechoslovakia, and there's a wonderful Broadway play that used to play on that. A little here, a little there. But that's basically what Putin's now saying. Oh, if they only allow me to bring back all the Russians. Well, Jesus, I mean, there are Russian settlements in New York and London. There may be some here in Sydney. In which case, you know, oh yes, they want to self-determine. They got together right downstairs and decided to self-determine. They passed a referendum. And so that's basically, I mean, the argument. That's a tough argument.
The question right down the back, yes.
Just assuming there is a peaceful resolution of the whole thing, how does the new government keep legitimacy in order not to have a change that will happen to the guys on the within a few years?
Assuming there's a peaceful revolution, how does the new government in Kyiv retain its legitimacy?
So it doesn't get kicked out.
It doesn't get kicked out by another group.
Well, the bottom line is that actually that group's the only threat right now to the existing government, and this is a vital threat, is that the Russians do not accept it as a government. But the Russians ended up not accepting Saakashvili in Georgia as a viable government as things were falling apart. Does that mean that we have to repeat what they're saying? Problem is that if you repeat it long enough, and Goebbels knew that, if you repeat it long enough, then it might start sticking. But the fact is, when you say viable government, I'm not quite sure what you mean by viable government. There is a viable government. I mean, there is, believe it or not, if you know the history of the place, after February 25th, a very large chunk of Yanukovych's own party broke away and gave the parliament a constitutional majority. They could basically rewrite the constitution. And so, in effect, it wasn't just a simple majority. This was a constitutional majority. They could, in fact, constitute themselves as a national assembly and say, as a national assembly, we now rewrite the constitution. They could have actually done that. But there are too many other problems. And in fact, Putin created a problem immediately afterwards and said these are illegitimate. But the illegitimacy, I mean, where is the illegitimacy? I mean, the regions, the best example is one of the great regions is also a great industrialist / oligarch, Akhmetov. When people ask about Donetsk, well, will Donetsk break? Does anybody know that Akhmetov employs 300,000 folks in Donetsk and Luhansk? And if he's heading west, and his capital is heading west, I mean, how is it going to work? Unless you import folks from next door, the same folks that are telling us that there were 600,000, there was a report that there were 600,000 ethnic Russian refugees fleeing Ukraine. How did that work out in the news media? Okay, sorry.
Question here. Yes.
I'm interested in your separation of Putin from Putinism comment. Mm-hmm. And Angela Merkel's famous conversation with Putin, where she regarded him as having completely lost his marbles,
right,
and gone into a realm that is fantasy and that sort of realm of, I suppose, narcissism and mania that many despots inhabit. Do you think in all of this that maybe Putin has gone too far? And can you explain a little bit about Putin himself and whether he can maintain his sort of hold on the Russian...
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. And it's got two parts. First, Angela Merkel. I'm glad that you mentioned her. Angela Merkel, when we were talking about Europeans, we've been concentrating on Obama. We know the Canadians have done well. Abbott has done absolutely brilliantly. We know that Harper's done well. We know that some of the Western leaders really have come up and without a lot of coaxing. We know that Obama is changing because he's got Kerry and he's got Biden. And both of those are dedicated Euro-Atlanticists. Merkel has not played a very good role. Didn't play it in 2008, when in Bucharest, and yes, but not now, both Georgia and Ukraine. How did that work out for both Georgia and Ukraine? That's one. And this is when both had democratic governments. And she also knew, and I'll say it right here, I'll say it openly, she also knew in July of 2013 that Yanukovych, as much of a bandit as he was, he might want to do this European thing. But she knew that Putin was going to start a trade war. Putin started a trade war. The way Yanukovych became a coward, which he was to begin with, but now a full coward, is that he understood then that his electrical base, whatever he had, which was in eastern Ukraine, would be shut down. Central and western Ukraine trade with the European Union. It's eastern Ukraine, his base, that would absolutely have suffered all the casualties of a trade war. And she should have warned the rest of us. And she really didn't. And I know that I'm on camera, so that's disappointing. And we're worried because what she's redeeming herself now, because there's a part of us men that are always worried when the Germans and the Russians start talking behind doors. Remember the 39, how that worked out. Right, and so in effect, when she is now saying that Putin is losing his marbles, that is saying an enormous amount. When she is shocked by what he's done, knowing that she's the one that has let him do this, she's the one that invited him to the Bucharest thing to talk to W and explain to W, you know, George, you really ought to understand that Ukraine really isn't a country. And, you know, Crimea really doesn't belong to them. And the East is really not stuck to the West. And, you know, if it fell apart, man, I'm not sure you would miss it. That's how Putin put it to George. But who invited Putin to say that to George? It was Angela. And I think she's in absolute shock. She doesn't recognize it. And that's troubling, because you're right. That means that what is he capable of? And is there some sort of... has he snapped into the irrational? If he's snapped into the irrational, then we all have a problem. Because he happens to have nuclear weapons. So yeah, that is a problem.
There's a question here.
Just on the point you mentioned, the nuclear weapons, the Budapest Memorandum of 1994 that was brokered by Bill Clinton and the UK, Russia and Ukraine asserts the integrity and sovereignty for disarmament. Now that was reaffirmed on the 4th of December 2009 by President Obama and then President Medvedev, and President Putin is very much aware of that. So a lot of the arguments, so the undertakings or the expectations of the Ukrainian government now, shouldn't they have an expectation of both the US and UK, the signatories to the memorandum, to uphold and intervene as much as possible in the current situation?
Okay.
That's actually a very good question, and I can answer it very quickly because we had a get-together. We had a forum about that. The Americans and the Brits walked the dog back in the 2008, 9, and 10 period when they said, we never said guarantees. We said assurances. The Ukrainians took it as assicurazioni, garantie, you know, one half a dozen to think, right, missed in the translation. So you guys can interpret it this way, we can interpret it. The guy who clarified it for us, you got to love this. You really do have to love this. 4 weeks ago, the guy who clarified that it was guarantees was the chief advisor to Vladimir Putin, Mr. Sergei Glazov, in a moment of true insanity. He said, of course, we said that we are the guarantors of this protocol. Oh, how wonderful. You really mean that you thought that you were the guarantors? You mean you thought that the Americans and the Brits were also guarantors? Well, that's just dandy with us. They themselves have used the word guarantors. The Russians. They understood there was guarantors. But in doing that guarantor, they're saying, that's right. And there's a vacuum of power. That's why I answered that question the way I did. There's a vacuum of power, and we're worried that that means that they're not looking, if he's not really all that well, he's not looking for Crimea, he's not even looking for new Russia, those six little provinces along the Black Sea. He may be looking, oh, there is a hole in power in Kyiv itself, it's anarchy, it's civil war, right on my border, it's Syria, Ukraine, all these extremists in Kyiv, oh, Al-Qaeda extremists in Crimea, I have to move in. Because I'm a guarantor of the territorial sovereignty of Ukraine. And we're worried about that guarantee. We would really be worried. Yes?
Let's assume that the West will put a lot of pressure on Putin to back out. They will also allow him to save face and leave the back door open. What that door would be, do you think?
That was a question that was asked today. Oh, sorry. That was a question that was asked at one of the institutes today. And it's a good question. My suspicion is that if they really want to press him, they would tell him this. When the Ukrainian government, you want that referendum and you want to own Crimea, when the Ukrainian government shuts off all the electricity and water, because that's where it comes from, mainland, and you don't have a bridge into Kerch, you don't have it built yet, so how are you going to resupply anything? You're going to have to fly a lot of stuff. You're going to have to ship a lot of stuff. I'm not quite sure his capabilities are that large. In fact, that, and if the Crimean Tatars do what they do, I'm not quite sure he'd be able to handle. He may really have a problem in Crimea. And that's basically where the West has to stand very firm and say, you're creating your own problem, and if the Ukrainian government, which has every sovereign right to that land, shuts off your electricity and water, it's not antagonizing you. It is doing what it has the right to do. That's where the West can do it. The second part of that is, you want to do this de facto? Fine. But we're guaranteeing that in a year or two, Ukraine, the rest of it, is heading for EU and NATO, and no questions asked. You watch how he starts now backtracking on Crimea itself. But you got to be very strong. The West has got to be strong, that strong.
We take one very brief final question down there. It's got to be brief.
I was in the Ukraine, right. And at that time you're talking about embargoes where the Russians had prevented fuel, aviation fuel, there were no flights in and out, and very little food. And based on that period of time, it would seem that the Ukraine is not going to buckle under, and that if it does lead to military action, it doesn't seem to be based on that experience, which might be different today, that the Ukraine would succumb easily.
The suggestion is that in 1993, despite the Russian embargo, Ukraine did not succumb. The suggestion is that in a similar situation, it wouldn't succumb today. So a final comment on Ukraine.
Right, and that actually is what I've said. That's why I think it would be protracted, because I agree with you. I think the Ukrainian government wants, and it's coming close. This is not something that we can say we've got a month to think about. 4 days, this Sunday. Once the Russians have that referendum, at that point, that referendum, and the referendum itself is the reunification with Russia. And the Russian Constitution has been working. My friend Herman Pershing has put out a book, Remaking Greater Russia, in which the Constitution, nobody noticed it, but in 2001 and 2, they changed the Constitution to easily bring in new territories. If he begins to do that, and you have several thousand Ukrainian military personnel on the territory, they're still there. At that point, we're going to have to cross, this is going to be a very dangerous point, because the Ukrainians will have every right to say, well, this is our sovereign territory. The Russians will be now saying that it's their sovereign territory. And the big question is, who's right and who's wrong? It's up to the West to say, you know, in some ways this referendum is bogus. Territorial integrity, that's the whole issue. If the West begins to waffle and say, well, de facto it's gone, and the Ukrainians can't do anything about it, they can't, let's say they can't shut off the water or electricity because that's going to antagonize the Russians. Well, then Putin can take the rest of eastern Ukraine because he can start bringing folks there and say, well, but we can't antagonize the Russians. At that point, man, you can lose half of Ukraine under those circumstances. So the question you're asking, I didn't want to dodge it, but the question you're asking is the central question. It's interesting, it's the last question, but it's the central question. What will happen in the next week? And as you've rightfully pointed out, that new Ukrainian government, which has gotten a mandate, and it's kids that died, and there's a lot of hurt in Kyiv. And Kyiv is not in western Ukraine. Kyiv is in central Ukraine. And you can see all the folks that were bringing the flowers, they were coming from all parts of Ukraine, including Crimea. There's a lot of hurt there. Yes, if this becomes a duke out between the two sides, okay, I'll leave it at that.
Many thanks. Well, there were more questions. We couldn't take all our questions, but it's right on time. So I just want to say the timing has been quite extraordinary for this speech with the referendum on at the weekend. Many thanks to Dr. Walter Zariski for coming here today and giving us a general overview of the Ukraine-Russia relationship with particular emphasis on Ukraine. It'd be great to publish a paper, and we look forward with concern but certainly with interest about developments, and hope everything works out as well as it can. Many thanks.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.